And please turn back with me to 1 Samuel chapter 15. That's 1 Samuel chapter 15. And tonight, very briefly, we're just going to have a little look at Saul as a king of Israel. And as we go through this evening and we think of Saul, just have this question going around in your mind. Who is responsible for the church here at Amien Park Chapel? Let's have that question going around in your mind. Who is responsible for the church here at Amien Park Chapel? So King Saul, 1 Samuel chapter 15. And here we join King Saul. He's under his second command from God in verse 3 to utterly wipe out the existence of the Amalekites. The Amalekites themselves, they've long been enemies of Israel. They've raided it, they've fought against it. And as referred to in 1 Samuel 15, we're told that whilst going through the wilderness on the way from Egypt to the Promised Land, they greatly harmed the people of Israel. In fact, they so much so, Deuteronomy 25, there is a specific reference to Amalek and the fact that God will one day wipe them out. That's what it says in verse 19 of Deuteronomy 25. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Well, God commands for Saul that he is to do that today in 1 Samuel 15. And Saul goes out to war with a mighty army, doesn't he? And he does defeat the Amalekites. First, he warns the Kenites. The Kenites have previously been allies with Israel at various points. They've previously been good to Israel. They're dwelling in that land. And so they don't get caught up in the slaughter. Saul forewarns them and they leave. But as we read, though Saul conquers Amalek, he doesn't utterly destroy them. He spares King Agag in verse 8. And he keeps the best of the livestock and the animals. Of course, the sick and weak are destroyed. But he keeps the best for a sacrifice in verse 9. God tells Samuel in verse 12. And Samuel is furious. Furious at this disobedience. And as I said at the beginning, this is the second command. So Saul has disobeyed before. But Saul's disobedience doesn't seem to register, does it? It doesn't seem to register. His actions don't seem to be wrong to him. On his return from defeat, we're told, he's coming back via Carmel. He builds up a little monument to his victory. And then he passes on to Gilgal. Gilgal is a place in Israelite history where they typically offered sacrifices to God. And of course, behind him, they're going off to Gilgal to sacrifice all these animals. He's going to have this huge caravan with him of soldiers, their army, and of course, all the various livestock that they've preserved, and King Agag. There's a big caravan following him to Gilgal. As he arrives at Gilgal, he's confronted by Samuel, isn't he? And Saul declares his obedience very confidently, doesn't he? What does he say? He says to Samuel in verse 13, "Blessed be you of the Lord," talking to Samuel, "I have performed the commandment of the Lord." Saul declares his obedience, which has a big sense of irony, because whilst declaring his obedience, he's heading up a great big caravan of evidence of his disobedience. And Samuel sees this because he makes this angry but also sarcastic comment. "If you've obeyed, Saul, what's all this cattle noise I can hear? Because I shouldn't be able to hear it if you've obeyed the command." It's a very good reason. Saul recognizes that that's a very clear observation from Samuel. So what does Saul say in response? As well, "We did destroy everything as you've commanded, as God commanded. The people, though, have spared the best animals because they wish to sacrifice to the Lord. So we're here to make the offering at Gilgal. That's why we're here, Samuel. It's for a sacrifice." And as far as we can tell, Saul is telling the truth. That's why they're going to Gilgal. He didn't sort of make it up to cover up his disobedience. That's why they're there. It's a genuine reason. And there's no reason to think that that wasn't actually the circumstances. The people most likely did request that they make a sacrifice instead. And most likely Saul just said yes. That's fine. Well, Samuel now confronts Saul with his disobedience. And he makes it explicitly clear, doesn't he? He says, it's very clear, Saul, you were to destroy the sinners, the Amalekites. You're to fight until they were consumed. Verse 18. So why then did you disobey Saul? It wasn't ambiguous. Why did you pounce on the spoil? Saul now twigs. He seems to realize his disobedience. He realizes that Samuel's pointed out his error. And you get this sort of awkward response from Saul. He suddenly changes his language and sort of reshapes what happened. Samuel, it wasn't me. I absolutely have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have kept the commandment. I've captured the king. Although that, of course, wasn't... he was supposed to have killed Agag, but Saul still says, no, I destroyed them all, but I've kept the king. You know, I've obeyed. It's the people. But the people took the spoil, Samuel. The people have taken the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord. It's the people. Samuel, I did what was commanded, but it was the people that let the side down. They took, and they have come to sacrifice. It's now in 1 Samuel, you get probably what most people know the book of 1 Samuel for, these words of Samuel to Saul, and it's his rejection. And they are very, very profound words. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. So the Lord delights most in obedience to his words. Other things, sacrifices, they're good. They're good, they have their place. There's nothing wrong in sacrifices. But obedience is first and foremost. All other forms follow after. And Saul, you and Israel have got it wrong. In order to do a good thing, you have disobeyed on the most important thing, God's command. And Saul, you are the man who's done it. You are the one who's rejected the word of God. And you've led the people with you. So you are rejected as king. Because Israel's king rules under God. On hearing this, as we get to verse 24, Saul confesses his error, doesn't he? And you see, the thing for Saul, the problem for Saul is not that the people asked for a sacrifice. It's not actually that the people went and committed the sacrifice, that the people did that. It's because Saul, when given the choice between obeying God's commands and the people's request, he chose the people. What he should have done is he should have first, when the request was made, he should have declined it and said, no, we're going to follow the command of God. It's clear, categorical. God doesn't want this sacrifice. He wants them destroyed. And then if people sacrificed anyway, he should have completed the destruction and then punished the disobeying people and then asked that God did not punish the nation for the sake of the few in rebellion. It's the pattern the Old Testament puts forward. Instead, he's confronted heading the whole caravan to sacrifice at Gilgal on their way to disobedience. Well, Saul immediately puts his finger, he actually honestly puts his finger on why he did it. He recognizes what went wrong. He says, no, Samuel, you're right. I have sinned. I have transgressed the commandment of God. And I did it, Samuel, and I'll admit it. I did it because I feared the people. I feared the people. And he's right. He did fear the people. But the interesting thing is, he's not repenting. Because in admitting he fears the people, he then does something immediately because he fears the people. As soon as he admits his error, and he's right on his error, he asks Samuel to turn with him again to worship the Lord. Why does he do that? Why does he suddenly want, okay, Samuel, I've done wrong, let's go together and let's go and worship the Lord? Well, we're told in verse 30. At his second request, he reveals the real reason behind his first one. All the elders and the people are here, Samuel. Everybody's watching. Turn with me again so that we together can go and worship the Lord. He fears the people. Samuel says, no. We just cut back to the verses after verse 24. Samuel says, no. In fact, Saul, the kingdom, and the reason I'm not going with you, is because the kingdom's been taken out of your hand. It's going to a better man than you. In fact, it's going to go with someone who's going to be your neighbor. They're going to become a continual reminder to you of the man you should have been. And we know that man to be David. And he does become Saul's neighbor, doesn't he? In fact, lives in the palace, certainly frequents it and eats at the king's table. He's a man who will obey the voice of the Lord. Well, as I said, verse 30, Saul protests for appearances and Samuel does relent and they go and worship the Lord. But Samuel's the one that has to go and make things right. He's the one that has to go and kill Agag. But although Samuel relents and they go together, there isn't a reconciliation. After this incident, Saul never sees Samuel again. Until at the earliest, 1 Samuel 30, when Saul dies. So what's the assessment of Saul? What's interesting about Saul? What defines him as a man? Actually, God gives his assessment of Saul in 1 Samuel 15, verse 17. Because actually, although Saul's problem was that he feared the people, there is a deeper problem to Saul. I'll read it in the ESV, but it's slightly different in the NKJV, but it's the sentiment's still the same. It's this. Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. This is God's assessment of Saul. If you actually read Saul's life prior to 1 Samuel 15, come through 1 Samuel 15, and go all the way to 1 Samuel 31, where Saul dies, after you read 1 Samuel 15, 17, you start to notice a musical drumbeat to Saul, almost from the start at his coronation, that he's a physical and mental contradiction. The Bible describes, I think it's 1 Samuel 9, verse 2, that he is head and shoulders above all the men of Israel. He's not a giant, but he is a giant of a man. But he sees himself as the smallest man in Israel, inferior and weak. That is why he goes and fears the people. He is anointed king of Israel by Samuel. He's crowned in front of all the people in 1 Samuel 10. And he's there with the people, and he's made to solemnly swear that he will fear the Lord, serve him, and obey all his commands. And as the first king, he figureheads the people. He is to lead them in their obedience. He is bound in his position and privilege as king to do so. And the thing for Saul also, you see, is that it's not just his responsibility as king. Because he's king, he actually has the right to demand it of the people. He has the power to make them obey. His rejection as king in verse 23 can seem harsh if you read 1 Samuel 15 on its own. But he's failed to obey before. Actually, for the same reasons. Direct commands of God as king. And there's a pattern. The people always seem to win him over. If you read chapters 13 and 14, look out for the phrases "the people" or "but the people." Whenever obedience is demanded of Saul, he does not seem to realize that it is his obligation as king. And he doesn't seem to realize that he has the rights and powers to do so as king. Instead, he seems to only ever see himself as a man who lost some donkeys once and one day came home to be king. He's always see himself as so small in his own eyes. But he's now king. He's now king, says God. And God points out his mistake. You see, because you're now king, Saul, you have to live up to it. You've been given a calling. You've been made the leader in Israel. You may be little in your own eyes, Saul, but you've been given the kingdom to care for. You have responsibility for it. You must therefore live up to that responsibility. Well, two brief applications this evening. Application number one is this. We, if we are Christians, we have a gospel calling that is worthy. We have a gospel calling that is worthy. Something I often find I need to remind myself of is this. Particularly when things are hard. Is that as a Christian, God may call me or command me to be different. But it's because he has called me to be something incredible. He has called me into something that's incredible. And it's something that the world doesn't know and doesn't understand. I'm sure nearly everyone here was here this morning. And hearing Abbot Allen's sermon this morning and his previous ones in Ephesians. Have you been listening and have you been thrilled by the Jesus that we are seeing coming out in Ephesians? Seeing everything that Jesus is, all that he has done, all that he has achieved, all that we have, as Alan said, in him. All that we are called to. It's not sort of done over there. Thank you, that's Ephesians. I now get some of the difficult bits in chapter 1. That's helpful. No, it's something that we know not over there, but in here. If we believe and trust in him. It's something he has done for and to us. Listen to what the gospel calls us to. This is what 2 Peter 1, verses 3 and 4. His divine power, referring to God, has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. Granted us all things that pertain to life and godliness, into God's own glory and excellence, possession of his precious and great promises, partakers of the divine nature. 1 Peter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. A royal priesthood. Not only of a royal bloodline, as it were, spiritually, but also you stand before God face to face, the priest. A holy nation, set apart, dedicated for God. You're possessed by God, his people. It's what we are as Christians. It's our calling. It's what we have been made. It's what we are to become. 1 Corinthians 1, 20, verse 26 to 31. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that it is written, let the one who boasts, boasts in the Lord. While we were still far from God, yes. Whilst we were still nobody to God, yes. Whilst we were still nobody, even to the world, to that standard, Jesus has become my wisdom. He's become my righteousness, my right standing before God. He's become my sanctification. He's become my cleansing from sin, my purity, my perfection. He's become my redemption. He's become my payment to release me from captivity. Everything we have in Christ, the calling that we have. And there are others. You could do Philippians 3. There's 2 Thessalonians 2, 2 Timothy 1, Hebrews 3. There's lots that talk about looking at your calling. Look at what you have been given. Look at what you are called to. Look at what you will inherit. Look at everything you have in Jesus. If Saul was a king in splendor, power, might, his calling, his privilege, that's nothing, is it? He got just a metal crown on a constructed throne for 40 years, both of which have now ended thousands of years ago. But we, if we're Christians, have an eternal inheritance into a kingdom that doesn't end. And within the kingdom, we're royalty. We're priests. Excuse me. It's the calling that we have. If you're not a Christian here tonight, it's quite simple. You have none of those things. In fact, if you choose your own way, the greatest privilege you ever have is what you have now. Which, if you think what you have now is pretty rubbish, well, then all you get is rubbish. And perhaps it might get a bit better. Maybe somehow you do become a king like Saul, but he's still only got 40 years. Maybe you get some wealth, but it still gets taken away. And maybe you're here tonight and you're looking at Christians. You may have popped in and thought, I wonder what it's all about. And you're thinking, these Christians, they really are a bit of a loser, aren't they? They really are the biggest losers, in fact. Actually, they're the biggest winners. And they're the biggest winners for the reasons I've just said. Because they're called of God. Because they've chosen to listen to his voice. They've decided to have Jesus above everything else. They've asked to be God's possession. They've asked for God to remake them. They've asked God to forgive them, to make them right and fit for Him. Why don't you, if you're here just visiting, listen to the preaching this morning. Listen to the grace that God has. Look at what He's done for His people. And Christians have that because they've asked and because they have believed in Jesus. They have trusted in Him and His cross. So God has been gracious to them. No, He hasn't given them the world, because I think most people will admit that the world is a bit rubbish. And it doesn't really last. You see, through His Son, God has given His people everything forever. And do you realise you can have that too? You also can have that. I really do pray that one day, if you're sitting there thinking Christians are the biggest losers, that God will open your eyes to realise that they really are the biggest winners. And that actually the biggest losers are the people who choose to reject God. Especially realise that, because at the moment, God offers open arms to accept you. God says that that calling can be your calling. That inheritance can be your inheritance. Perhaps you're someone who feels your need, and you do see the world as unsatisfying, and you yearn and hunger for something more than this world can offer. You do see that things are passing away. You do see that things will eventually come to nothing. Particularly, I think at the beginning of this, in 2016, there was this big spate of celebrities that died. Lots of David Bowie, Alan Rickman, sort of really famous ones, sort of hitting that generation now where the celebrities of yesteryear are reaching that sort of age. And there was, it seemed palpable at work, people feeling the fragility of life, sort of movie stars and celebrities they'd grown up with and felt would last forever dying. Maybe you've become to realise that. The world doesn't last forever. Things that I assumed would keep going on are not. Well, God offers you a purpose and a joy and a privilege. He offers you Himself. He says, "Become a follower of Me, and I will give you real lasting life. I will give you real lasting joy and peace and rest." Become a Christian. Come to Jesus. The Bible even challenges you. It says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." Perhaps you feel your sin. Well, what God offers to you is a reconciliation. He offers you a relationship. You long for peace, perhaps. You long for safety. You do really feel that if you were to die tonight, you genuinely fear what might happen. The thing is that the sins you feel seem so fixed and permanent, immovable, unforgivable, uncleanable. This is what God demands of you. And He does demand something of you. That's what the psalm says, David's psalm. It says, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, You will not despise." That is what God demands for reconciliation. He just demands a broken spirit to come to Him. one who pleads for forgiveness. That broken spirit he never despises. And as we heard this morning, in Jesus, all can be dealt with. You just need to come to him. The calling of a Christian is the most incredible, most privileged calling. And no one should despise it. But there's something very, very important. Philippians 1, verse 27. Excuse me. A very famous verse. Paul, talking to the church at Philippi, exhorts them to something. He says, if you are Christians, Philippi, if you follow the gospel of Christ, walk worthy of it. And it's a charge laid down again and again in the New Testament. In fact, it's a charge that comes out. If you read, say, 2 Peter chapter 1, we stopped at verse 4. If you carry on, Peter states the implications of the calling, what's bound up with the calling. And it's a charge of what is expected of those who claim to be called of God. Bound up in the wonder and glory of the calling is the responsibility to walk worthy of it. And application number 2 is this. I must fulfill my calling. And as we're thinking of Saul, the single subpoint of that, a little refinement, would be this. I mustn't think that what God expects of me is only what I feel I'm able to do. You see, there's a big danger. When we look at Saul, we see a big danger. A big, big danger. Are you someone who thinks very little of themselves? When you assess your capabilities, do you find that you cannot help but look around and think that everyone else seems to be far better equipped than you? In so much better position than you? And you seem to always focus on the things you can't do and the things you don't have. Maybe you look at your life situation and your assessment always seems to look at all the restrictions that you have upon you, all the barriers and limitations. And every time you look at someone else, the only thing you can ever think of is how enabled they are, how free they seem to be, how available they seem to be, how unconstrained they seem to be. When you look at situations, you look at your abilities, oh, there's work and I can't get the work so busy, I can't fit this in, and there's family, such responsibilities, and there's friends, and there's distance, and there's just so many things that encroach on me. Is that sometimes how you think of things? Is that sometimes how you look at things? Or perhaps there's something a little bit different. And again, some of these things, there's caveats to them, but we can't go into that. But take what I'm saying. Perhaps there's something a little bit different. And you can find yourself, and sometimes people are like this, they sort of love being very introspective and examining and trying to unpick as many wrong things and sinful things about them as they can. They love to focus on being the horrible sinner. And there's a right and healthy recognition of your sin and your failings. But sometimes they're just these people, I don't know if you've met them, I sometimes meet them, and they seem to have an almost overriding preoccupation and focus on always trying to find the worst things about them, almost glorying in being vile and morose. Or if you're like that. Well, there's a danger. There can be an unhealthiness to it. And it's an unhealthiness we see in Saul. Because in one sense, there's nothing wrong with Saul seeing himself as small, is there? That seems like a good thing. But for Saul, it became a big problem. because he fell into something that we could probably call as a wrong sort of humility. A wrong sort of humility. When Paul writes to the Philippians, we said to Philippians 1, in Philippians 2, verses 3, Paul says this, talking of unity and cohesion in the church at Philippi, he says, do nothing of selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. But very importantly, Paul goes on in verse 4, and he says, let each of you not only look out for your own interests, but also the interests of others. When you read Saul, there's something interesting, isn't it? There's something interesting in it, and it's this. Although Philippians, granted, wasn't written when Saul was there, if you were to look at Saul, you would say he sort of only got so far as verse 3. Because he's forever focused on how small he is, he seems to esteem everybody greater than himself. It's why the people always win. They won in chapter 13. If you read chapter 13, the complaints of the people and their desertion with fighting at a battle leads him to break God's command. It's his first proper breaking of a direct command. And he sacrifices when he shouldn't have done. Then the people won again in chapter 14. Paul makes a very rash vow, that's granted. But it's a vow he makes before God. And it says the people ransomed Jonathan that day. The people. The people proclaim to Saul and he bows to them. Then in verse 15, desire for a sacrifice. So he stops the slaughter. But Saul, you are called to be king. Your charge is to stand up to the people. Your charge is actually to accept the fallout of their anger, their annoyance, their complaints. And you're to do what's in their interests. Obey the Lord. Your humility doesn't lie in putting yourself under the people. It's actually to take up your responsibility towards them and accept the fallout for fulfilling your duty. For suffering for your duty. That's where your humility lies, Saul. See, when we read and mentioned reading 2 Peter 1 and everywhere else, you realise that our responsibilities as Christians are woven into our calling. The calling is tied to commands. So like I said, beware of a danger. A danger that Saul suffered from. Because humility should not drive ourselves to thinking that we're incapable or too small to live up to our calling and serve the Lord. It should not become the danger of saying, I am not capable, therefore not responsible to God for things. The wrong kind of humility, you see, tells me that my calling is always the least and the lowest demand on me, and it's everyone else's responsibility to pick up the greater demands. That's the wrong kind of humility. The wrong kind of humility tells me that my weaknesses define my responsibilities. I'm only accountable to God so far as I feel able to do things. The wrong kind of humility says that I'm always the one in need. I'm always the victim. And it's others that should be stepping into me. The right kind of humility instead says this. With Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. Instead, it makes me willing to suffer the hardship and difficulty associated with meeting the calling in serving the Lord. As we outline, that's what Saul should have done. The right kind of humility makes me realize that actually I need the strength and support and wisdom in meeting my responsibilities. The right kind of humility says, actually, I should always be seeking to help others, even if I'm the one that is still suffering need. And the wrong kind of humility is so dangerous because it feels like real humility when we exercise it. But it demands little of me, or sometimes nothing of me, But it can make me feel so godly when doing it. Think of Saul. Until Samuel really gets to the unpicking bottom bit, he thinks he's being obedient. He thinks he's doing good things. It can often make us feel so godly. I'm unworthy of suffering the hardship, loss, and difficulty. It sounds so humble. We mustn't be a Saul in this. You can almost call it a sort of a Sauline humility, if you like. Because God will send us Samuels to stop us on our way. But if we have a Sauline humility, our response will always be like his. It's someone else's fault. It was the people. It's their responsibility. I did my bit. Well, the kingdom gets torn from Saul's hands, doesn't it? Just an example to work this out. You see, there are many areas of church life, aren't there? And there's lots of things in the scriptures of our own personal lives. Hospitality, evangelism, there's visiting the old, sick, suffering, the lonely. There's youth work, there's chapel building things, discipleship. There's many, many things as a church that we do. And I'm sure there are many, many things as a church we know we could do. As Christians, there are many things that we know the scriptures demand of us. Well, don't be a Saul in them. Hospitality is not just for the good cooks with the big houses, and it's also not for others to be hosting me. Evangelism, sharing the gospel, is not just for those who are excellent speakers. Discipleship is not just for those who are in charge, the elders or the deacons. The most difficult roles may in fact be the ones for me. See, we are a family here, aren't we? We're all together. We may have differing skills. Some may have particular roles. They are good things. Some may be leaders. Others may be our seniors, just in terms of spiritual experience that we still look up to. But we are all jointly responsible, aren't we, for the individual witness, life and experience of APC. So we should never have a they and the church. It's always an us and we. Because God binds our responsibilities into the hope of our calling as Christians. Because we, the church, are responsible for the church here at Amiens Park Chapel. I wonder if this is something that I try and catch myself doing. So I find it helpful, just a little bit of practical things. Try and catch yourself when you refer to things, and generally it's when you point out something negative. You find you automatically talk in the third person. A bit like Saul going, the people. Because the irony with Saul saying that is, firstly, Saul is an Israelite, so he is one of the people. He is also their king, so above everybody, he is one of the people. But he still refers to it in the third person. Is that something we do? I often do it myself. We distance ourselves from things as if the church is something over there. Well, catch yourself saying it, and instead say this, say we or us. And don't do it because it might help make things better. Do it because it's true. It is we. It is us. We are called. We are chosen. And bound with our calling and our chosenness is our responsibilities. Well, there was once a king called Saul. He was given a kingdom. And he didn't have to fight to obtain it. It was given to him. He was anointed. He was just coronated. It was freely given. He had God on his side to help and support him. He had good, faithful instruction under Samuel, teaching of God's word. But the kingdom was taken away from him. He never gave the calling of a king and everything that it entailed its due duty and privilege to him. And he saw out the duration of his reign, yes. But he had no inheritance. We would do well, wouldn't we, if we were a Christian, to avoid being the New Testament examples of a Saul. The Christian calling is secured in Christ, yes, and all that he has done for his people. And God does take the sacrifice of his son seriously. That is how we are brought into the calling, isn't it? And he takes it very, very seriously. But the wonderful thing about the calling of God is this, and this is the wonderful thing about the way God talks to us in his word about his calling. And if you read through the New Testament, hopefully this is something that chimes through when you read it. He does not call for your obedience, waiting for the one slip of failure for destruction. He instead makes you look forward. And he says, recognize that Jesus really is worthy. So when we think of our calling, we want to take to heart, don't we, that it is a wonderful, amazing calling. And it's not something we are terrified by for obedience, for losing it. Instead, we look forward and we say, no, he is worthy of my obedience.